On the phone right now, I'm happy about this. On the phone, I have Mark Horowitz. Mark, how you doing?
Hey. Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday, that's right. I introduced at the beginning of the show around 2 o'clock. I told him, you know, I always tell him what's going to happen and who's coming on. And I describe you as this, and I know you're just a sheepish kind of shy guy. I'd said if there's a big wheel that we could describe as the New York banjo scene, which kind of sounds like hip talk from the 50s, you know, the beatniks, the scene and everything. But there was a big wheel that we'd call the New York banjo scene. All these little hubs that would come from all these big names, all these little spokes, rather, would come down to this hub. And I think somewhere around that hub, my opinion, you don't have to agree, would be Mark Horowitz.
Well, thank you. If only from longevity alone.
Well, you've outlived the rest of exactly what I meant. and I told him a little bit about, well, you're calling now from where? Joe Val Festival, right?
Right, the Joe Val Bluegrass Festival in Framingham, Massachusetts. It's a hotel, self-contained kind of a winter bluegrass festival with some very good name bands, including the Steve Canyon Rangers, which you just played.
Yeah.
And a lot of other people here, the Selden Scenes here, Bill Keith and Jim Rooney are here.
Well, drop, see,
some good stuff happening.
See if you can drop some names while we're talking. Speaking of dropping names, I tell everybody this right away, just to kind of like whack them in the head with a 2x4, get their attention. Who was Bela Fleck's first teacher, Mark?
Well, actually, the answer may surprise you. Eric Darling was his first teacher.
All right.
I know you were hoping I was going to say me, but I was his second teacher. Bella was about 15 or 14, living on Riverside Drive in New York City with his mother and brother. And he had started playing banjo in high school and was taking lessons from Eric Darling, who was the folk-style banjo player who replaced Pete Seeger in the Weavers.
Okay, God, thanks.
Right. So Eric called me one day and said that he had a student that wanted to learn, you know, Scruggs style playing, and that really wasn't his thing. And could he pass him on to me? So I said, sure. What's his name? And he said, Bela Fleck. I said, no, really, what's his name? Because Bela Bartok is my favorite classical composer.
Oh, gotcha.
So that name immediately struck me as, and as a matter of fact, Bela is actually named after three classical composers, Bela, Janusz, Anton Fleck. And so Bela started with me when he was around 15 years old, and we worked together for about a year and a half, I would say, maybe 2 years on and off. And then he wanted me to teach him so much of Tony Trischka's stuff that I was barely learning it myself in time to show him. And I finally said, you know, perhaps you should go take some lessons from Tony. So that's what happened.
Well, you were, I guess my question should have been away from the folk style into the three finger style. You were the guy that introduced Bela to finger picks, I guess, maybe.
Well, yeah, I guess you could say that. And he was, as you might imagine, a tremendously absorptive student, and basically, after the first half a dozen or so times we got together, he started coming back, resetting things that I had showed him in a different way. He was extremely quick on the uptake and had a lot of original thoughts, even at 15, 16 years old. So I knew he was going to be a monster.
About when was that?
This was 1973 or 4, I would guess.
Well, he jumped right from that into the within a year or two of Newgrass Revival, I guess. Then
he went to Boston for a year and played with a band called Tasty Licks, which was led by a mandolinist named Jack Tottle. And after serving time with them, he came back to New York to visit his folks and called me up and said, "Hey, I want to come over and play you some stuff that I've been writing." So he came over and sat down, and I had the presence of mind to put a cassette into my Wallensack cassette recorder, and I ran the cassette while he played some of this new style banjo composition that he had started coming up with, and the stuff was mind-blowing. And I had that tape for years and years and years, and about 8 or 9 years ago, I guess it was, maybe a little more, he told me that he was doing a project with Tony called Works for Solo Banjo.
Mm-hmm.
On Rounder, and he asked me if I still had that tape. And I told him I did. He said, "Well, if you send it down to me, I can digitize it. And if I find a track that I can work with, I'll put it on the record and give you an engineering credit, which is exactly what happened. He found a track that he could, you know, clean up digitally, and he put a title to it. He called it Twisted Teen, and it ended up on that Solo Banjo Works album.
I remember, I don't want to talk about him, but when you're talking about the time frame you're talking about, wasn't he 15 or 16 when he did that Crossing the Tracks album?
No, he was 19. No,
19. Oh, wow, that's a whole different matter then.
Yeah.
He was no longer a child at 19.
He was precocious, but not that precocious.
Because I think that's the one that he did. He did that Chick Corea. Did he do...
Spain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's when I put my banjo back in the case and decided to go to law school. Oh, man. Well, so I asked you, we talked earlier this week, and just for people that have just tuned in, I'm talking to Mark Horowitz. And we talked earlier, Mark, this week. I never knew the answer, and you had a very quick answer for me. I thought it would be long, complicated extrapolation. But here's the question I asked you was, and we've had a lot of these banjo players from New York on the show, but I never understood until Tuesday why all these banjo players came out of New York City. And you had an answer, and you sent me homework, for which, as I've told you off the air, I'm not finished it yet. Mark sent me a 160-something page doctoral thesis about answering this question. But answer to you was like, to me, it's like, oh, finally, now I get it. So explain to people why there's, you know, Tony Trischka and all these banjo players that pop out of New York.
Well, basically, New York, you know, post-war was a hotbed of counterculture and, especially in the liberal Jewish household, there was a lot of interest in folk and ethnic music, and people had gone to various camps like Bucks Rock up in upstate New York, which were like work camps for kids of left-leaning families. And a lot of these families were Jewish families.
Mark, did you go? Yeah. Did you go?
No, I'm here.
I mean, did you go to the left-leaning family?
Oh, no,
camp?
Did I go to Bucks Rock? No, yeah. I wasn't part of that scene. I went to camp, but I went to kind of I went to rich people's camp.
Okay, good. Good for you. Okay, go ahead.
My father had money in the 50s. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
But basically, the New York folk scene developed out of that Jewish liberal post-war kind of household that had all of these cultural interests in various ethnic studies. And players, well, first of all, I don't know how many people know the name Roger Sprung. Roger was an older guy. He's about 80 now. But he was the first New York City banjo player to play Sprung-style banjo, and that was probably in the early 50s, maybe 51, 52.
And a really inventive guy.
Yeah, he actually had played a brand of music he called progressive bluegrass, which basically meant that he dared to play tunes like Malaguena and Big Banjo from Broadway and things like that.
which, of course, the bluegrass folk crowd loved.
Oh, yeah, of course. But Folkways recorded him. I think he actually had progressive banjo, progressive bluegrass 1, 2, 3, and maybe 4. And the first one featured Doc Watson as a sideman. So that was an interesting phenomenon. But then, you know, the whole New York scene developed with banjo players like Eric Weisberg and Winnie Winston and Steve Mandel. And I started playing in 1960, actually, June 4th. I bought my first banjo in 1960.
Wait. You remember the day?
Yeah, the reason I remember the day is when my father sold his house in Brooklyn when he remarried after my mother passed away a couple of years later. I went to the house the day the movers came to take everything, and I just kind of was nostalgically roaming around the house, and I went into the basement where I spent a lot of my time practicing as a kid. And it was a finished basement with knotty pine walls, and it had these benches around the periphery of the basement with the storage compartments in the bottoms, and I used to keep all my treasures in those compartments. So I opened up each one, looking inside, just kind of remembering things I used to put in there. And I opened one up, and there was a piece of paper lying face down in the cabinet. And I reached in and took it out, and it was the receipt for that first banjo.
Oh. What had
been there since 1960.
What did you buy? What was your first banjo? Mine was
a K. It was a Belltone.
Okay.
Yeah, just kind of an off-brand. I bought it. It was purchased in a pawn shop, Gem Pawn Brokers in Brooklyn on Atlantic Avenue and 4th Avenue.
Did you have a resonator or no?
Yeah, I had a resonator.
Okay. Tone ring?
No, it was very simple. You know, it was a $35 banjo.
Okay. Some of the names you went through in that list there, and I want to slow down just a bit. And of course, you mentioned Eric Weisberg and Steve Mandel and stuff like that. And people here are listening, a lot of them, I will say this, I think I have a very sophisticated audience at this particular show. They've been with me long enough to know the kind of music that we play. I'm not saying I'm smart, but I'm just saying, in other words, it may deviate from your normal Flat and Scruggs, which I love. But yeah. Eric Weisberg, tell the people who Eric Weisberg is and where he played a part in this.
Well, Eric was a Juilliard-educated musician, actually. He studied bass at Juilliard. But way before that, as a child, he was a folk musician and played banjo, guitar, mandolin, and a little fiddle. And I became aware of him through an LP called Folk Banjo Styles, which is a phenomenally pivotal event, the release of that record for many of the New York banjo players to come. It was Eric Weisberg and Marshall Brickman, who later turned out to be Woody Allen's collaborator in writing.
That's right.
And a writer for The Tonight Show, and, you know, he's a very well-known writer.
And when he talks about his writing now, he doesn't really talk about those days with the music, which I always wait for him to get into it. I've seen him interviewed since, well, it's Marshall Brickman. He talks about all these things he's writing, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, he kind of treats that as a different part of his life, yeah. I guess. Yeah. But Eric was one of my early banjo heroes, as he was for many of the guys. And when I started going to Washington Square Park on Sunday afternoons in Greenwich Village to play music with the people around the fountain, I met Eric and Steve. And Eric was an accomplished player by then. This is probably 1962. And he had been playing with the Carriers, a very well-known folk group, and He was very, very kind to me. He was very nurturing. And as a matter of fact, as I got to be a better player, he started bringing a fiddle and mandolin down to the square on Sundays instead of his banjo and let me play banjo. So I'll always be grateful to him for that. And that scene, basically, I used to refer to that Washington Square Sunday scene as the University of Bluegrass, because on any given day you'd see Roger, Eric, Winnie Winston, who's been gone now for about 6 or 7 years, and myriad other people. Just, you know, anybody that was passing through town knew about that scene. Grisman was there a lot.
Wow.
Andy Statman came down when he was about 15 years old. He'd been playing mandolin for about a year. And as a matter of fact, I was a member of his first band. We had a band with Gene Yellen, who was Bob Yellen's younger brother, called the Saddle River Boys back then for a little while. So it was a very seminal kind of a stewpot scene where you know, you'd play with a few people and then the group would break up after playing for an hour and coalesce into different groups, and we'd stand out there and bake in the sun for 6 hours until the cops kicked us out of the park at 6 o'clock.
You know, when you mention Washington Park, I mean, that's just one of those. It's almost like mythical now. Of course, you lived through it, but now guys think back and you rattle off those names, and that whole period of what you're describing as it occurs. It's just one of those periods where people like me, you just see black and white photos of it, and you think, man, that was so cool.
Yeah, well, that's a time that unfortunately will never come again. You know, there was a certain innocence and a certain you know, gestalt that was in the air that just was conducive to people playing music together and trading ideas and germinating different kinds of music and different combinations of music, you know. It was just a very, very important part of my musical education, much more so than anything I learned in school, you know.
So in that experience, and you were obviously the names, you're of course you're one of those names when they talk about who was there, by the way. So you're getting all this experience and all this exposure to different sounds and different styles, and you got Weisberg there and all these other people that you've mentioned, and you just keep absorbing it. And I think from what I understand of your playing, you're kind of like, you play like every style. I mean, you're a Reno, you're a Don Reno.
Don Reno was one of my early influences, and when I started going to some of the bluegrass parks like Sunset Park in Pennsylvania, which is no longer around, Winnie Winston and I used to drive down and see Reno and Smiley and Flat and Scruggs and Jim and Jesse and the Virginia Boys and the Stanley Brothers, and it was just a phenomenal period of time during the early 60s. And I actually became quite friendly with Don Reno, and actually I'm in a picture that was taken on stage at the NYU Loeb Auditorium back in 1972. When Reno would always invite me up on stage to play a few with the band. And there's actually a picture of me in Reno's souvenir book that he used to sell up on stage with them. But, you know, a lot of what took place in Washington Square and in the parties that we would have to get together and play was what we call these days networking. So when gigs started becoming available for people whose playing had matured enough, I started getting called for recording sessions and such. Eric was actually, again, very instrumental, no pun intended.
that was too easy. You're going to have to try harder than that to get me to bite, but that's...
But Eric again was very generous because he was first call for banjo, mandolin, and pedal steel in New York City for years. And when he got too busy, when he had conflicts and already had a date booked for a certain time, he instructed the answering service we both used to call me. So I got a lot of my early sessions through Eric's good graces.
Yeah, that's good. Well, and you've done a lot of session work, and describe what you mean to the audience. And we're talking to Mark Horowitz, by the way.
You know, it's the same thing as, you know, a lot of people know what the Nashville scene and the LA scene is like. You're a hired gun. Basically, you get a call from a producer or from a service that the producer uses saying, be at such and such a studio at such and such a time. It's a jingle for Noxzema, and you're going to be playing banjo and mandolin. And you would just show up at the appointed studio at the appointed time with the appointed instruments and read the paper. You know, more often than not, they had your part written out, sometimes just chords, but sometimes you had to play a line. I remember the most devastatingly embarrassing session I was ever called for was a 50-piece orchestra was doing a bunch of tracks for a Brazilian singer who was very popular in Brazil at the time. And I showed up, I was called actually to play guitar, and I showed up, and the other three guitar players were Jay Berliner, who was like a number one New York session guitarist, Darn Arnone, who was a big band guitarist from the 40s and 50s, who was still doing session work in the 60s, and Vincent Bell, who invented the Belzuki and the Carl Electric Sitar. Some of your electric guitar fans might remember those devices. And me. And these guys, of course, could all read fly excrement off of paper.
Thank you. I have no delete button, so thank you for that one.
Yeah. But, lucky for me, the horn section was having a lot of trouble getting their parts together and gave me time to puzzle my part out. But that sometimes you get, you know, called in over your head, and that can really be a real knot tightener. But that session scene and you know, Broadway shows, I played a few of those and did some film scores. And, you know, that kind of thing carried me through the 60s and 70s, along with touring with Judy Collins and Steve Goodman and a bunch of other singers. So.
You just keep dropping those names on me, man. I
know
you're doing
it on
purpose. Well, you
know, it's basically my employment history, you know, up until about 1979, when I just really got tired of the phone not ringing sometimes and went to work, actually worked for Mandolin Brothers, the noted Staten Island instrument dealer from 79 to 85, while still doing session work. And Stan was very good about that. He would let me take off and do what I had to do in terms of music because he felt it was good for the shop to have a professional working musician on the staff. And then in 1985, I became a sales rep for St. Louis Music, which is a big manufacturer and distributor of amplifiers and guitars and hundreds of other things, and stayed in the repping thing and even to this present day.
Oh. Now, you recently did, we've talked on the show before, and I had Tony on a while ago, Tony Trischka, talking about this. The New York, actually, when I interviewed Tony, the New York Banjo Summit hadn't begun yet, but it was in the works.
Right.
And you've participated in that.
Well, yeah, I participated in one show because back in October, just before the hurricane hit, they were booked to play into the Pace University Auditorium in Lower Manhattan. And Bailey had called me and asked me if I'd like to sit in, and I was delighted to be asked, and I was really looking forward to it. And then the hurricane hit and they canceled the show, so it was rescheduled for January 20th, and I got to do it, and it was just bags of fun. I got to play a clawhammer duet, a trio rather, with Bela's wife Abigail Washburn and Richie Stearns from the Horseflies. And then I also participated in a tribute to Earl Scruggs medley. And at the end, we did a big finale, everybody playing Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Oh, you got to do that. Well, why else will people come if you don't do Foggy Mountain Breakdown?
Of course. So it was a great memory, and I'll always treasure that. But Bill has always been, terrific about keeping in touch with me over the years, and he's a friend, and when someone talks to me about him, I basically just say that whatever else I've done in my playing career, the thing I'm proudest of is having had anything to do with his development in some small way, because to my mind, he is the most versatile, adaptable, and brilliant musician working in the acoustic music scene.
Well,
he's not only a great player and composer, but he's a great producer and leader, and he's a musical force that makes things happen.
He was the producer on that whole Throw Down Your Heart that he went to Africa for. He actually put
all
that together.
Well, he financed it himself, too. He put that whole project together. He had his stepbrother was the cinematographer, and he used all of his own money for that.
Wow. I've never met him. I've seen him on stage 1,000 times. Seems like a nice guy. I hope you're going to tell me that's correct.
Well, even if it wasn't, I wouldn't tell you, but it happens to be true. No, he's just a very, very mellow, very, very low-key. I've never seen him exhibit anything akin to a temper or a temperamental stance on anything. He leads by nudging rather than pushing. Mm. He takes charge of a situation when it's his situation, but he does it in a way where you think it's your idea.
So, that's difficult. That's difficult.
Yeah, and every musician that I know that's ever worked with him on recording or live has said the same thing. He's just a pleasure to work with.
I have to tell you, when we were setting this interview up, Mark sent me. Because I'm always looking for photographs so I can give them off to the network, the Worldwide Bluegrass, and they run things. And I throw things on Facebook all the time because people follow me on there sometimes. You gave me a bunch of pictures. I used the banjo stud picture with the sunglasses and the mud chops. The Village Banjo. That's what it was. I posted that on Facebook, and people, and I said, this is Mark Harwood. They said, what are you talking about? They thought it was somebody. I said, no, that's him. That's actually the guy.
That's why I had hair.
And big old sunglasses, too.
Yep, aviators. How did they have aviators back then?
Well, you had to. I think they issued them, when you went to the music school, probably.
That's right. Well, it's like Charlie Brown said, or Linus said, back in Peanuts, back in the 60s. He thinks that it's such a cold, cruel world. He thinks that whenever a baby's born, it should be issued a banjo.
I've seen that panel on Honest.
Oh, yeah. It's been reproduced many times.
It flies around, and I'm thinking, well, what would really be the end towards doing that if you thought it through?
Yeah.
You
have a very noisy world.
Well, yeah, you think of babies with banjos, and then you think of that cacophony and all that noise. There would probably be a bounty on banjos after a short while, don't you think?
Right. Banjos are in season.
Oh, boy. So you're in between sessions. You got another workshop coming up there soon, I think.
Yeah, in about 10 minutes, I got to get down.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, listen, hey, Mark, thanks so much for calling in. Anytime you want to call in, you have open. You know my number. You can call me whenever. You can talk about whatever you want to talk about, whatever you're doing. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. Thanks for the history. I'll do my homework on that doctor's thesis. What's the name of that again?
It's the Jewgrass Boys.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a young man's master's thesis. I believe it was for Harvard or Yale. And it's about a 175-page study of that phenomenon we talked about earlier, how bluegrass and banjo came to be so important in the New York music scene in the 50s and 60s. And it's very informative, and I was interviewed for that as well, and there's some very good factual information in there.
I like that.
It's available on the Internet. It's for free download. You'll just Google the term, the Jewgrass Boys, and you'll find it.
Okay. I think it's great. I mean, I was so thrilled when you told me the answer. And you said, here, by the way, there's a doctoral thesis on the same thing. I thought, well, if I'd have Googled it earlier, I wouldn't have to bother Mark with it. But that's more fun.
And I didn't have to write it, so it was even better.
That's right. You just have to be interviewed. All right. Well, listen, you got to go back. I this has been a blast. I have spies out there. I have pictures of you with Bill Keith last Thursday. I knew you were going to because you told me. So I got people sneaking me pictures of that, and I'm working on getting that Eric guy working on getting that Eric guy to call in. Eric Weisberg to me is one of those, you know, watershed recordings and all that stuff that he did blew my mind. But
well, he's got some great stories, so he'll talk your ear off. It'll be fun.
Tell him to call me.
I will.
All right, Steve. Mark, have a good time. Thanks for calling in, buddy. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.